This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by the Civic Engagement Podcast, Future Hindsight. Join host Mila Atmos this week for a look at what the U.S. would be like if we legalized all drugs with Columbia professor Carl Hart. Tune in to understand why we should regulate and tax everything, even heroin, and how legalization can be a benefit for the country and our democracy. Available wherever you get your podcasts or at futurehindsight.com. And now, for this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 25th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, Ryan Grimm, will be here to look back on the week in politics. Also on the program today, a body language expert, David Cross, who also happens to be a comedian. Meanwhile, at least four dead, 159 people now unaccounted for in a Florida building collapse. Joe Biden endorses the Senate Gang of 10 infrastructure deal. But Pelosi, Schumer, then frankly Biden, say no deal if it doesn't include a reconciliation complementary bill. Meanwhile, the White House breaks the speed record for lifetime judicial appointments amongst modern presidents. The DOJ is suing Georgia over their voter suppression law. Trump reportedly wanted the military to attack peaceful George Floyd protesters. U.S. announces it will search former Native American schools for the remains of children in the wake of mass grave discoveries in Canada. CDC extends the eviction moratorium for a measly 1 month. Leaked UN draft report scheduled for February of 22 shows we have accelerating climate devastation. And nearly all of the 18,000 people who died of COVID in the United States in the month of May were unvaccinated. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Happy Friday, and a happy Friday to you, Emma Vigeland. How are you?
I am well. How about yourself?
Are you excited for the weekend?
Yeah. I mean, I got to do some traveling. It's my stepmom's birthday, so I got to go far away. It's going to be exhausting, but, you know.
Wow. It sounds like you're really looking forward to that. Happy birthday, stepmom. There you go.
Move on.
All right. I didn't realize it was such a sore spot. Boy.
It's not. I'm looking forward to it, but it's just a lot of traveling and I'm tired. We had a big week. I don't know if you recall.
Nope. Not so sure about that, but all right. Let's just let that be there. Just want to just highlight that last headline that that I mentioned. I mean, this is really incredibly stunning. And in some respects, incredibly tragic. It's hard to say that one death is more tragic than another death. But the idea that we have the ability, or people have the ability, to prevent themselves from dying of COVID at this point, and are not, either are not able to avail themselves of this opportunity, or are unwilling to avail themselves. And we are getting closer and closer to the latter group being the overwhelming majority. They may already be the majority of people who are not vaccinated. The vaccinations are free. Certainly understandable why many people are skeptical of that. I've actually have heard stories of outfits attempting to charge for vaccinations. And surprise billing is a real thing in this country. So I can understand some people's skepticism in terms of the cost. And some people have trouble getting out to vaccination sites. I mean, we have, I think it's something like 85% of over 65-year-olds have been totally vaccinated at this point. There were 18,000 COVID-19 deaths in May in this country. Only 150 of those, maybe a little bit less, had been fully vaccinated. 150 out of 18,000. That translates to a less than 1% death rate for in terms of death rate. 18,000 deaths in May, or I should say, the fully vaccinated, 5 deaths per day. It is estimated that we have around 80 to 90 people a day who die of the flu in any given normal year. So that number would be extraordinary if we had full vaccination in this country. And remember, the more vaccinated the rate of vaccination is, you're also going to see those deaths come down even for the unvaccinated, because there's less of an opportunity for them to get COVID. We're not going to reach that 70% milestone that the Biden administration wanted on July 4th. But I would imagine if they had released projections of death and hospitalization, they would have probably overestimated where we will be on July 4th relative to these numbers. The vaccinations are just simply working, I think, far better than anyone could have imagined. Meanwhile, let me start with a little bit of a correction. I don't know if you picked up on this yesterday, Emma, but on Wednesday, the reporting looked like the bipartisan Gang of 10 infrastructure deal was essentially on life support because they couldn't come up with the pay-fors. And then yesterday, Joe Biden comes out at the White House and makes this announcement. They have like a little mini celebration. Here it is.
We had a really good meeting. And to answer your direct question, we have a deal. And I think it's really important. We've all agreed that none of us got what we wanted. I clearly didn't get all I wanted. They gave more than I think maybe they were inclined to give in the first place. But this reminds me of the days we used to get an awful lot done up in the United States Congress. We actually worked on it. We had bipartisan deals. Bipartisan deals mean to compromise. One of the things that I've made clear, I've signed on, and I'm going to let them give you the detail, because, and you can ask them, and I will talk to you all later, next hour or two, but I promise you I'm not going away. One of the things that we agreed on infrastructure, we made serious compromises on both ends. And they'll give you the numbers. But we did not, they did not, and I understand their position. Republicans and this group did not want to go along with any of my family plan issues, the child care tax credits, the human infrastructure that I talk about. And that we'll see what happens in a reconciliation bill in the budget process. If that, if we get some compromise there, and if we can't, see if I can attract all the Democrats to a position that is there. But we're gonna, they're gonna move in a dual track, and that's all I say. But I want to thank each and every one of them. It's been, you know, a lot of us go back a long way where we're used to doing one thing, give each other our word, and that's the end. Nobody questions it. They have my word. I'll stick with what they proposed, and they've given me their word as well. So where I come from, that's good enough for me. So I'm going to turn it over to the two chairs here, and I'll talk to you all a little bit later.
So just a reminder, Joe Biden has been living in Washington for 50 years. So if it's good enough, that's where he comes from, I guess. Or I'm not sure exactly where. Now, with a couple of things just to point out. There were 10 people there. Five of them were Republicans and five of them were Democrats. Let me remind you again of the math. They need 10 Republicans before this can happen. It's unclear if that is real. Joe Biden has gone on to say that he will not sign just the bipartisan deal. He must sign both the reconciliation and the bipartisan for him to sign either one. So,
which in and of itself might complicate the bipartisan deal because we already have Lindsey Graham basically on shaky ground. They need five more Republicans, obviously, and the entire Democratic caucus to hold together.
There was, about 2 weeks ago, 11 Republicans who had sort of signed on in principle to the bipartisan deal that didn't exist at that time. Lindsey Graham, upon hearing that the success of the bipartisan deal hinged upon the success of a Democrats-only reconciliation bill, said, I'm not doing this, which was highly predictable. If it wasn't that, it would have been Joe Biden wore a blue suit. So I'm out. But we're going to talk to Ryan Grimm in a moment and get a sense of just what is going on here. I can come up with a scenario of like this is a train wreck, and I can come up with a scenario of like this is pretty smart negotiating and strategizing based upon the reality of the situation. I can hold both those ideas in my head right now. Maybe Ryan Grimm will give us a little more clarity. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, Ryan Grimm, after this. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is sponsors for the day. What's
an
that?
An ad. I was going to say an ad.
An ad. Well, also, not just an ad. I should tell you, folks, if you check out, let's pop this up, the Majority Report store at shop.majorityreportradio.com. We don't have that other one yet.
Oh, sorry.
We don't have it yet. But check out the new merch we got. We got, by popular demand, baseball shirt and tank tops. If we sell, I'm trying to think of a number that is that just occurred to me.
Yeah, it makes
how many do we need to sell before I wear one on a fun half?
Oh, I thought you were making a separate promise. A tank top?
Yeah.
1,000 in a week.
1,000?
I don't want to see you in a tank top. I'm joking.
Maybe. Well, I'll tell you what, folks. If we sell 50.
Oh, my God.
Well, that's not that many, is it?
No.
I was going to say, like, we could do it quick because you're not here next week, and then you could avoid seeing the the tank top. But it's suns out, guns out. Yeah. If we sell 100. I'll do it on a fun half. There it is. And we'll do one of those like partitions or something. But then I guess you have to see it on the Zoom. Maybe we'll get you dark sunglasses. So check out shop.majorityreportradio.com. We're going to have some merch that was inspired by Steven Crowder, and I hope to be able to announce that on Monday. So keep refreshing right. That page.
I thought that's what you were teasing, and like that was the goalpost. No. Okay.
We don't have it yet. I want to make sure that we were able to get it. folks, this program is also sponsored by one of our movement sponsors. We've got two. We've got justcoffee.coop, which is having a special sale this week. MR25 gets you 25% off of Just Coffee Coffee, justcoffee.coop. Check it out. They've got the MR blend. They've got such great coffee. They're a co-op, and the way that they treat their suppliers, it's all fair trade, but they go beyond that. It's not even just the way that they price it. It's that they do not abandon their suppliers, their farmers in Central America, Africa, when they work with them when there's droughts. They work with them. They just don't walk away from them like your normal coffee roasters do, bottom line. They do not perceive their relationship with these farms as merely transactional. So check it out, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the code MR25, special this week, 25% off. Great time to try out some of your favorite things you've been wondering about trying out. And our other movement sponsor, these guys, sunsetlakecbd.com. Left is best, gets you 20% off. I got to say that those last three letters in a very funny way, or sometimes it gets a little complicated. But Sunset Lake, they have all sorts of products. There's a tremendous amount of integrity just in their CBD because you like it when I do that. They have third-party testers. And so you know what you are putting into your body. Also, it is pesticide-free. They use integrated pest management. They use 100% organic fertilizer. They work with the University of Vermont on regenerative farming practices. They are incredibly responsible in the way that they grow their product and the way that they treat the land and our environment. And they're incredibly responsible as employers. $15 minimum wage up in outside of Burlington, Vermont. They are mostly employee-owned company, and they are donating to movement causes, supporting the nurses, St. Vincent's in Worcester, on their strike that is ongoing. They support local community organizing and support mechanisms for families. Just really a great bunch of people. They've got infused fudge. They've got gummies. They've got smokables. They've got tincture, which is incredibly helpful for sleeping for me. They've got a salve. They've got lotion. They've got infused coffee, which is a great weekend blend for me. Check it out. 20% off. Left is best. SunsetLakeCBD.com. And also, last sponsor of the day. And I have to say that I have used Headspace in like really stressful times. I know that this is something I should do as a daily practice, and I'm trying to work my way up there. But in stressful times or when I am not able to sleep, Headspace has been really, really helpful for me. It's your daily dose of mindfulness. It is in the form of guided meditations, super easy to use app. It's one of the only meditation apps that advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. There are 25 published studies on Headspace's benefits, specifically 600,000 five-star reviews and over 60 million downloads. Need some help falling asleep? Check. Overwhelmed? Check, check. June, May in particular, very stressful. I'm not exactly sure why these would have been more stressful than during COVID. Early on, COVID was pretty tough, but Headspace was very helpful. It has wind down sessions, 3-minute SOS meditations. There are even meditations for kids. Headspace works on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. It really is. Now, I know it's a practice I should be doing on a daily basis. I should just do it. It's hard for me to remember to do it unless I'm like in a really stressful situation. And then I do it and it's very helpful. but it's like, I don't know. I guess I'm like a sort of, it's like Pavlovian. I need to get like a shock treatment. You deserve to feel happier, folks. And Headspace is a meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/majority. That's headspace.com/majority for a free 1 month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/majority today. All right, folks. Want to welcome back to the program Washington Bureau Chief. There's his email, if you're curious. Ryan Grimm. Ryan, welcome to the program as you connect. Yes. That must have been, I hope you don't love that email address that was up on your
screen.
It didn't
go out.
It didn't go out.
Oh, yeah. It didn't? Oh, okay. Okay, great. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Oh, say hello to Emma Vigeland.
What's up, Emma? How are you?
I'm well. How are you? I mean, I love when Sam commands people to say hello to me. That's
Ryan.
He doesn't do it every day.
Very chivalrous.
I know.
Yeah, well, and Ryan also doesn't have the manners as a lot of our guests say hello. So
I didn't say hello to you either. I just said it's nice to be here.
I noticed that you seem equal much nicer to
equal
Emma
opportunity
than you were to me.
Yeah.
So all right, Ryan. On Wednesday, I read reporting that the infrastructure deal is dead, more or less. It looked like they couldn't figure out what the pay-fors are.
That's how you know they're about to strike a deal.
Is that really true?
Yes. It's a pattern that I've observed for 15 years.
What? Why?
Because people are trying to get last-minute concessions. And so if they can try to bluff that the whole thing is going to go away, then they think they can get these last minute little things given to them. And so reporters on Capitol Hill, whenever you start seeing that chaos, like it's all over, it's done. We're all going to die. There's no deal. That's when reporters are like, okay, time to pre-write the, we have a deal piece. Cause it's coming.
Well, it's the same thing in sports, right? When you know, there's a tough negotiation process between a player and the team, the agent will leak to the media that things are falling apart, and then the team will squeeze an extra million out, right? It's very similar.
Yeah.
Okay. What was, to use that analogy, what was the extra million? Do you have a sense of like what were those last things?
It was probably around the pay-fors, like around the taxes. And maybe they got Democrats to cave on, you know, there's basically no tax increases in this. And that's why people thought it was unlikely to happen, because Republicans were saying we want it to be fully paid for. Democrats were saying great, tax the rich, tax corporations, and there's no bridging that. And so they eventually found enough kind of fake gimmicky pay-fors to cobble it together.
So what were those pay-fors in this deal? I mean, I'm less concerned about those than some of the other provisions. I mean, we haven't quite seen it all yet, but
Like unspent. So like, well, the best one is they're going to close the IRS tax gap. You know, they're going to actually spend money to go after rich people who are dodging their taxes. Probably the most absurd one is they're going to sell oil out of the petroleum reserve to fund electric buses. It's like, what are we doing? Really? We're going to burn oil for this green infrastructure package. Okay. But that's like, whatever. It might marginally decrease the price of gas, which Biden probably likes, you know, in the very short term, it'll pop right back up immediately. And, you know, you got to refine a little more gas to fill up the reserves, but which then drives up the price, because then the US is buying to fill its reserves. So it's kind of neutral. There's what's called asset recycling. And this is something that people need to watch very closely to try to figure out what actually gets in here. That's the new name for privatizing public assets.
Right. And there's been quite a bit of written about this. I think David Dayan had a piece the other day. And you and I'm sure maybe 15 years ago talked about what was going on in Chicago when they sold off those parking meters. That was the perfect example of the failure of the privatization. They sold these things off at a fire sale, in part because there was also some debate as to like what days they would go on. And the city, I think, didn't want to deal with that. And so they sold it off to this hedge fund, essentially, for, I don't know, 10 cents on what the of a dollar that it could make. And not only did they lose out in billions of dollars of revenue, future revenue, they also lost the ability to say, like, we're going to have a no parking meter day,
right,
you know, downtown where you can go shopping or you can walk around or something, because they got to pay for the lost revenue.
Yeah. One of the worst examples of privatization ever, for sure. So it depends. The devil's in the details on this. What do they mean? Did they just put this like, and maybe this was the thing that Democrats caved on at the last minute, said, okay, fine, put this on the list of things that we'll consider as we're writing this legislation. But what actually gets into the legislation is going to be key. Like, are they going to sell off the Tennessee Valley Authority, like some people have suggested? Like, that would be insane. Or is it something fake? Like, not fake, but like, it, one of the things was a 5G auction. Which brings up what they're doing. They're finding things that they were going to do anyway,
right?
And attaching them to this.
Interesting. Okay, so 5G auction is just we see this sometimes with radio waves. We saw it it is basically just saying, we're going to rent to you or lease to you long term the ability to use the airwaves, mm-hmm. and that's something that government has been doing for, I don't know, the advent of radio, I guess,
right,
on some level. So, all right, with all that said, how real is this anyways? Like, what is going on? Because there's like multiple layers of how much this may not even be real in the first place. And like, I'm not even clear like who this is serving or what, but the Gang of 10 is at least five shy of where they need to be, right? And all of those five need to be Republicans. Just walk us through that dynamic.
See, not necessarily. And the political press corps is actually behind on this question, because we're so used to saying that you need 60 votes, that we just assume that you need 60 votes on everything. But if you back up 1 second, like, why does this bipartisan deal necessarily need 60 votes? The only reason something needs 60 is if somebody filibusters it. No Democrats are going to filibuster this thing, even if they hate it in the end, because it would any Democrats who hate this are also Democrats who very strongly want to get rid of the filibuster. So they're not going to own themselves by then filibustering this this bipartisan package. What about Republicans? Mitch McConnell so far is supportive of this package. Lindsey Graham today said, I'm out. And so everybody's like, well, this thing's dead. Lindsey Graham was never in. This is a fake thing that Lindsey Graham does. He like positions himself right at the margin of a deal, and then he pulls himself out at the last second to, you know, show that he's tough. He wasn't one of those five Republicans at the White House. Lindsey Graham did not say that he's going to filibuster it. So you need one Republican to filibuster it to require 60. So maybe you get one. You know, maybe Ted Cruz thinks that, you know, his path to the presidency is to filibuster this bipartisan infrastructure bill. But I don't know. I don't see the political upside in that, because all of these Republicans know that if the bipartisan deal fails, then there's just more gasoline for the partisan one, for the reconciliation one. So I don't particularly think they're actually going to go ahead and filibuster this, which means with those five Republicans, you're up 55-45 right now. Rob Portman was actually asked on CNBC this morning, saying, like, why would you agree to this bipartisan deal when Democrats are going to ram through $6 trillion in spending at the same time? He's like, look, they were going to do reconciliation anyway. That's not on me. You know, this bipartisan bill, I hope, takes some energy away from their reconciliation package, but they're going to do what they're going to do. I asked Richard Burr, who's kind of retiring and he's on the fence on all this stuff, I was like, does your vote hinge at all on whether they do a second one? He's like, no, it hinges on whether the deal is good. I don't have any say in what they do after that.
Interesting. Well,
so why would McConnell not, you know, encourage a filibuster, though? I mean, what you're saying is all incredibly logical, but McConnell always, his first instinct is to obstruct, and then he can deal with, you know, potentially peeling off Manchin or Sinema from the bigger reconciliation package later, right? So I think a lot of what you say makes sense, but it flies in the face of what we know of Mitch McConnell.
He's kind of in a tough spot because of the reconciliation option. If there wasn't that option on the table, absolutely, he just kills this. And he's like, forget it, everybody filibuster this. But if he filibusters, so not only does this $1.2 billion package just immediately get moved over into reconciliation, all the bad things that Republicans negotiated in it that they actually do want, those get taken out. Then you move, like, the, let's say, the $800 billion that's good, and you move that into reconciliation. And then Democrats go to Biden. I mean, Democrats go to Manchin and Sinema. They're like, look, we told you, you struck a deal with these clowns. They showed up at the White House. They were backslapping. They were giggling. And Mitch McConnell blew it up anyway. The filibuster is useless. We need to get rid of it. All the filibuster does is empower McConnell. So he wouldn't get the policy outcome that he wants, because Democrats would still pass an infrastructure package and a bigger one at that. And he would fuel the end of the filibuster. So I think he's kind of in a jam here where he doesn't have a whole lot of good options. And I wonder if he's a little gun shy about his stupidity right before Georgia. Remember, I'm sure if he could go back and cut a $2,000 check in December to everybody and hold on to the Senate, he would happily do that. It's not his money, but he was overconfident. He thought that he could shut this down and he could still hold on to the Senate, and he lost it. So I don't know if he wants a replay of that. And his caucus remembers that too.
All right. Well, let's look at it from the other side, because this, am I wrong in assessing that, you know, a week ago, The Intercept had leaked audio from a Zoom call that Manchin did with some multimillionaire, billionaire donors from the Joe Lieberman-led No Labels organization. I'm trying to restrain myself. And what I found fascinating there was that, or of the many things actually in that audio, and people should really listen to, I think you guys did a podcast with Li Fong breaking it down. When Manchin said, you know, aside from the fact that he was basically more or less calling for them to bribe Roy yes. Blunt and Richard yes. Burr. I mean, I don't know how else to describe that. You know, encourage him with, you know, some type of form of compensation to vote a certain way. I mean, maybe that's a kinder way of saying it. But he also indicated that he was feeling the pressure, that he was aware that his argument about the filibuster was very tenuous because of that January 6th commission, which was the most low-hanging of low-hanging fruit when it comes to bipartisanship, yes. right? Like, it was about something that was like, I mean, literally just like a step up from like, hey, how should we continue to venerate the flag? And right. let's form a commission that will have every, you know, like, that will venerate Republicans and Democrats. I mean, it was like,
yeah, like, get like Sam Nunn, and like, it wasn't even putting regular senators. It's like, put the old statesman on.
Right. Yeah. And, but give Republicans and Democrats like equal, but it was like so nauseatingly bipartisan on some level, and they couldn't get votes for it. And he knew that made him look, he understood that this is not going to suffice. Like, he's indicating, I'm feeling pressure right. because I'm embarrassed by this argument now.
Right.
And is that all off the table? I mean, when they passed this infrastructure bill, are we done? Is the conversation about filibuster, does he no longer have to worry about the January 6th commission? He doesn't have to worry about that. He's like, look what we just did. We just did a bipartisan bill.
It'll help him, which is why there'll be pressure to make it work, and why, like, even though that Lindsey Graham's out of it, you know, that it has momentum, you know, for that, you know, significantly for that reason. And right, he can't go get Roy Blunt anymore, because now if Roy Blunt switches his vote, everybody would be like, oh, well, how much did that cost?
Right. Right. Like, people are going to actually scrutinize, like, how much Roy Blunt is going to be making in. Yeah, this is a what was that guy's name? Tauzin.
Billy Tauzin. Yeah,
Billy Tauzin. Yeah,
in quit the, like right after passing the Medicare Part D. Like
while he was
day.
Still in office, he announced that he was going to work for a big medical
for pharma. Yeah,
but so all right. So now is this? I'm hearing, you know, we've heard from like Burr and from and Portman about like, look, what they do with reconciliation is really none of my business. I can't control that. Manchin seems to be okay with this too.
Not just okay, but actively supportive of it. Because people don't realize, like, he wants things that are not in this package that you can get through. It's the American Jobs Plan. It's like half of it. Half that $6 trillion is American Jobs Plan. The other half is the American Families Plan. He wants things that are in both of those. So it's not just that he's okay with it. He's actively supportive of this money getting spent.
Does cinema have the same dynamic here? Because if you've got Biden and Pelosi and Schumer, and they all seem to be on the same page, it's almost as if they actually had a conversation about this beforehand, which
Schumer said they did. Yeah.
Which is encouraging. Are they, by tying this together, knowing the value of a bipartisan bill to cinema and Manchin in particular, because they're out on a limb telling, you know, progressives and everybody else, we don't need filibuster reform. So they need this as a way of taking pressure off of them. And then by tying it together, it seems like it makes the reconciliation process much easier for the Democrats, because cinema, if you have cinema and Manchin, then, you know, who do you lose at that point, really?
Right, exactly. And so Schumer said that he explained, you know, he was able to persuade Manchin and cinema that the only way you get this bipartisan package through is if you also do the reconciliation, because there's a 4-vote margin or in the House, and it's 50-50 here. And you've already heard from a number of senators and a number of House members, no climate, no bill. And so that pressure enabled Schumer to then go to them and say, look, you want to do bipartisan? You also have to do this. And it helps that Manchin in particular also wanted to do reconciliation. I think Sinema could take it or leave it. But they're helped by the fact that the media coverage of this is very confusing. The whole thing is confusing. And so the thing that filters out is that there's a bipartisan infrastructure deal. Once you start using the word reconciliation, you're down into the single digits of people who understand what the heck is going on. And so in general, what she can run on is, I did this bipartisan thing. I said I can make the Senate work, and I made the Senate work. Now, there will still be a showdown over the filibuster in late July. Manchin is still working with Warnock and Schumer and others on provisions in S1. On what he can agree to. You could see it both ways.
Just to be clear for people, S1 is the For the People Act, and Manchin has a sort of a revised version that is somewhere between the For the People Act and the John Lewis voting bill. This is the voting rights bill, with cutting out sort of some of that good government, let's not have corruption provisions.
Right.
Yes. That we wouldn't want if we're Joe Manchin, apparently. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. No, that's right. And he's trying to exact some things like mandatory voter ID. So like throwing some right wing things in there that Democrats are getting ready to cave to, because like voter ID now polls at like 80%, like across the board. Yes. Like, and people are now constantly showing their ID at like polling locations anyway. Like, people just expect that they have to show their ID. And so I think Democrats are ready to collapse on that. And so Manchin is like going to push some of those things in there. And right. And so that end of July, there, you could see this one of two ways. One could be they did their bipartisan thing. They proved the Senate works. They all move on. The other could be they did their bipartisan thing. They did reconciliation. They're giddy with the money that they've spent. you know, if you remember the feeling that Democrats had after that $1.9 trillion package that they passed, they were walking on air. Like, they're getting praise from the media. They're praising themselves. They're seeing the economy do better. They're seeing people benefit.
They're seeing Republican lawmakers who voted against the bill campaigning that as if they like, look what I brought home to you folks, even though I voted against it.
They're loving it. And so you could see maybe that they're feeling their oats in late July and they're like, let's just do the voting rights. Let's do it.
Okay. Because I want to circle back, but on this point, one of the things that I think Democrats rightfully got criticism for following that $1.9 trillion bill was that they moved slowly after that. There was a sense, there was that giddiness, and there was like a sense of like feeling their own power, and they just let it drain out of them in some way. Is there anybody talking about, hey, let's learn the lesson from last time, or is that just conjecture on your part?
No, they have set up, I don't know if it's the lesson from last time, but they have set up the schedule so that late July is going to be this moment for the second round of the For the People Act. And now that I'm thinking about the schedule, it probably flops and gets punted again, because you don't get the second round of reconciliation likely until August, and August, there's the August recess, so probably till September. So now you're looking at September for that showdown.
Let's talk about the reconciliation, okay? And the sort of the Democratic version of the infrastructure bill. Initially, Joe Biden laid out two tranches of the infrastructure bill. There was a $2.3 trillion one that had mostly like, steel and, like brick and mortar type of stuff. Also some internet stuff and about $400 billion, if I'm not mistaken, in elder care. And then there was another tranche that was about the same size that was more like, let's actually, make people's lives like better that they experience on a daily basis. Like, part of infrastructure is also like, do I have childcare? Like, almost like infrastructure for like the home or like family life on some level.
They've been calling it soft infrastructure.
Soft infrastructure.
Human infrastructure. They're calling it all sorts of stuff. It's like, okay.
But okay. And now we're hearing that Sanders about 2 weeks ago came out and said, you know what? I think $6 trillion is actually not the $4 or $5 trillion we were talking before. $6 trillion is actually the number. So what got spent? Like, if this bipartisan bill goes through more or less as the contours that we've seen now, what's that other $6 trillion? And, when I first heard Sanders come out with that, I thought, like, okay, this is a way for Manchin to come on board on the reconciliation and walk away and go, like, we got it down to $4.5 trillion. I really showed that Bernie Sanders. And I thought, like, brilliant, right? Like, Sanders is doing, and it feels like, to some extent, that the Democrats, I don't know if I trust it, that it's actually going to work out this way, but it feels like they're doing what, we were all saying is like, do what you got to do to get this money out the door. Like, do what you do to get this spending. How realistic is the $6 trillion now if Manchin and Sinema are heavily invested in the passage of reconciliation, regardless of what it is? They have the cover of the bipartisan bill, and they need that bipartisan bill, and it's just tied, like, wrapped around the reconciliation. How like, is it possible we're going to get a $6 trillion reconciliation bill? And I mean, when I contemplate $6 trillion of spending that is overseen by Bernie Sanders, I'm like, this is like party in the streets type of situation on some level. Cause we're talking about Medicare buy-ins or lowering the age of Medicare. We're talking about adding millions of Americans to single payer health insurance.
Right. Yeah. And when that was kicking around Congress, the immediate response from wasn't this is crazy, this is too much. The immediate response from a bunch of places was, wait a minute, you didn't include our, you know, $100 billion for dredging the Mississippi River, you know, whatever. Like it was, hey, don't forget this. Like, and you could very quickly see it go to like seven if that was the only pressure. The countervailing pressures coming from people like Kurt Schrader's longtime Blue Dog, who just said today, I'm not doing reconciliation, period. You know, forget it. So he's trying to set up this showdown where he's just like, forget it. $6 trillion. I'm not doing it. And then it's like, okay, well then you only have a couple more votes that you can lose in the House. So then do you either negotiate with him or do you just hold the line and say, look, we just need our 218. And Schrader, look, Biden has said he's not signing the bipartisan one unless we do both. And so that type of pressure from the right could see trimming it. But progressives in the House have said that the Medicare expansion, you know, dropping the age down to 55 is their highest priority. And then the question is, are they willing to draw a line in the sand over that?
How many Schraders are there?
That's what we're going to find out. There are far fewer than there used to be. You know, there he's a bit of a dinosaur, but there's Stephanie Murphy, there's Josh Gottheimer. You know, Gottheimer's unlikely to vote against it, though. Very few of them can withstand the pressure of the president saying, I'm vetoing, you know, I'm not going to do the bipartisan one. And then going back to their district and explaining, you know, why they were the ones that stopped this like bipartisan bicameral operation. So there aren't a ton of them, but the child tax credit, to answer your question, makes up a huge chunk of that money because it expands it at least through 2025. And there are people pushing to make it permanent.
And in 2025, deep into 2025, we should remind people would be theoretically either Joe Biden's second term or, you know, I don't know, maybe Joe Biden doesn't run and
Nikki Haley's first term.
And good luck to Nikki Haley to roll that back. Right? I mean, that is like, it's like another, and this isn't like the ACA where it's like starts off controversial. There's nobody out there going, you know, the Republicans aren't running against the child tax credit right now.
Right.
And so, you know, 2025, you know, when I look at that, I'm like, okay, that's not doom and gloom.
Right. And nothing's permanent in this world, even if you made it permanent.
Right. Of course.
They could always repeal it. So
when you say Gottheimer, I hear, salt caps going away. That's what I hear.
Right.
Like, right. I mean, is that going to be and we should just tell people when the Trump administration passed the 2017 tax cuts, one of the things that they did to sort of offset it and really to punish in their mind, blue states, I don't necessarily perceive it that way, but it was to punish the political class of the blue states was to say you can no longer deduct your, I think past $10,000, the taxes that you pay locally and for state, California, New York, high tax states where, you know, wealthy people relied on those deductions and presumably would have put pressure on those states to cut taxes, which has not happened.
Right. In fact, New York raised them, right?
And then it was supposedly going to lead to some type of capital flight from those states. And they're going to, you know, and that also, according to the data, has not happened.
Well, it's hard to tell because so many people moved because of the pandemic.
But according to the data that I have seen,
right,
they're not attributing it to the salt deduction.
Right. Because people like, if they're rich, they live where they want to live.
Exactly.
Not where they're forced to live. That's what it means to be rich.
only Rush Limbaugh spent 6 months a year in and a day in Florida.
That's why he claimed he was there. He loved it down there. Don't let him lie.
I bet you that's part of it too. It's like he just didn't.
He loved Daytona Beach or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. But and so it seems to me like that could be something that we end up seeing the, you know, maybe they'll pretend like there's some mitigation. Mm-hmm.
But you're right. Yes. Right. Gottheimer could be like, look, you want my vote for this? Salt's got to go.
So how much do you think is going to happen in terms of like of this $6 trillion bill? And walk us through the process, because there's a two-phase process, and walk us through the, we're hearing different Democratic lawmakers say there are different thresholds as to mm-hmm. what they will take as evidence that the reconciliation bill will actually happen. I mean,
right.
You know, that Joe Manchin won't get up to the moment and go like, wait a second.
Right.
I didn't like the font and right. I'm not doing this.
Right. So they have a recess coming up because of course they do. And then they're coming back, you know, mid-July. And at that point they will, what I've been told is that they've been in talks with the parliamentarian for a long time. They've been running legislative language by her. They've been, the two budget committees have been swapping language back and forth so that they'll be ready to go when they come back in July with the first piece of the reconciliation process, which is you go to the floor, you say, this is our top line number. And so that's when we'll find out whether they're going to do 4, 5, 6, whatever. They usually try to go high so that they can, you know, they have wiggle room if they need to go down, because you can't go up once you've said it. And then you have a voterama, which is tough because you got a bunch of very old Democrats who then have to be in the Senate all night long voting on endless amendments. So it then passes these reconciliation instructions onto committees. The committees then receive those instructions and they'll say, okay, we're allowed to spend $1.2 trillion. This is how we're spending it. And then they all kick it over to the budget committee chaired by your mans, Bernie Sanders. He reconciles them all back into another package and then kicks it back to the Senate floor where there's another all night or sometimes two nights voterama. And then it passes over to the House. That can be a 2 or 3 week process going from the floor to the committees, to the budget committee, back to the floor and then over to the House, which puts you into August, which is another recess. So whether they work through August or they hold it till after Labor Day, still remains to be seen. They might, you know, they're open to the idea of working in August because when they come back, they'll be fleshing out their bipartisan package and it can't sit there forever.
Right.
So they spend a couple weeks on that and pass it. You want to have them both ready because you've got people like AOC and the Progressive Caucus who are saying, I don't trust you guys to send me this. Like, we need it passed through the Senate. Like, we need it walked over here so we can lay our eyes on it before we vote on this first one. And then there are a lot of others who say, look, as long as it's through the half stage of the process, we trust that it's going to happen.
But so why trust that, right? Because Manchin, his favorite thing to do is at the 11th hour, no, I want the corporate tax rate ticked down by 3%, or I want right. this concession that makes me look like I'm some sort of deal maker. And it really doesn't matter what it is substantively, except that it hurts the Democrats. So that's what I fear about this.
Although he'll do that anyway.
Yeah, but that's what I fear about this two-pronged approach, right? Is because the larger tranche, to borrow from Sam, it's very fluid. And there are a lot of ways that Democrats could muck it up.
Yo, for sure. Right. I wouldn't trust them if I were them. So the only reason to trust them would be if you're several weeks away. I can't think of a good reason to trust them, actually. Yeah. I think you've got to have stack the votes and move them, you know, within a couple days of each other.
When AOC says, I'm not voting on the bipartisan bill until we are in a we're in the position of voting on the reconciliation till the Senate has their hands off it, because we all know it's the Senate is really the big issue here. I mean, short of a couple of people in the House, and we'll see how that changes. But does she have other people?
Well, right now she has the Speaker of the House, which is quite something. Like she threw down the marker that she's not putting it on the floor.
Pelosi said this.
But Ro Khanna had said it publicly before. The Progressive Caucus surveyed 95 members, surveyed its members. I don't know the exact total, but they said that more than half of them said we'll hold firm. Now they have said these kinds of things in the past and not, but this is a different scenario. Like you'll remember, they said they wouldn't vote for ACA without a public option. And then they voted for the ACA without the public option. But at that point, it was either take the ACA or get nothing. This point, if they say no to the bipartisan deal, they still get the reconciliation package. So it gives them a lot more concrete in their spine.
Right. And theoretically, it's like if they reject the bipartisan deal and they only get the reconciliation is going to undoubtedly be as good, if not better, even if it's not $6 trillion, than the bipartisan thing. So there's really, this is not an all or nothing situation for them. It is a go big or go slightly as good.
Maybe bigger. Right. It's not, and it's also, it doesn't have direct checks in it, and it doesn't have a bunch of vaccine distribution money in it, which was really jamming them in the COVID relief package.
Right.
So they had all of their constituents like, we're literally dying of this pandemic. We need this vaccine money, and it's got $1,400 checks in it that we need out the door. Everybody's calling them survival checks. So that made it a lot tougher for them to threaten to take it down.
All right. Two questions. One, when is Nina Turner's, is she in a special election? Is that happening in November?
No, it's a special election. I was actually meaning to look because she needs to hustle up August.
Yeah.
So, okay. There goes Kurt Schrader's vote.
It's sort of amazing that you could look at a special election for something like this type of legislation, and this one special election could make a difference.
Well, you remember when Scott Brown won his special election? That's
very
why.
Well, do yes, I do.
And it was the same thing. So they passed it with 60 votes, and the House and Pelosi said, "Look, okay, we'll pass this Senate bill that we don't like because it doesn't have the public option that we had." We didn't write it. It's not our favorite bill, but we'll pass it untouched, move it to the White House so it can be signed into law if you promise that you will fix a bunch of things with reconciliation. And then they fix those things with reconciliation and they move them basically through at the same time, the very same trust. And a lot of people in Washington said they won't do this. Like, this is impossible. There's too many moving pieces. But the incentives were all lined up, but everybody saw it as a legacy item. And this is as their last chance to like get something big done. And a lot of the same incentives are lined up this time.
You you wrote a piece in The Intercept, I guess it was yesterday. No, the Biden agenda isn't dead yet. And there was a little bit of like, this was, you got a little poetic. This was not, I mean, you were bookending this, everything we've just talked about, in the context of a lot of people talking about the end of the neoliberal age. I don't think the idea is that neoliberalism is gone, but it is not the sort of like accepted dogma of every single politician, regardless of their party, at all times. And if they pass a $6 trillion reconciliation bill, including, you know, the nearly $1 trillion in the first one, there are provisions in that I, you know, particularly the asset, you know, what they call reallocation.
Stuff,
that's pretty monumental. I mean, just even contemplating, like, people forget they couldn't do the stimulus when the world was collapsing in 2008 because of the word trillion. Not 1.5 trillion, not 6 trillion, the word trillion. And people forget that $800 billion to $750 billion, half of it was just tax cuts. They weren't spending anything. And I mean, I knew people who working at Citibank who were telling their husbands, take out every dollar you can out of the debit card machine right now because things are collapsing. And under those circumstances, they couldn't even like contemplate $1 trillion.
Right.
So, I mean, do you think, I mean, what do you think about, I mean, that just overall?
Right. If you, I mean, in Latin America, in Europe, in North America, the political commentariat is pretty united in the idea that the hegemonic neoliberal order has collapsed. Like, you're right, neoliberal elements are still strong, but this idea that they are just in the water, that they have this global hegemony is over. And so now the fight is on, you know, for what replaces that order. And you're seeing right-wing autocratic populism rising around a lot of parts of the globe, here in the United States as well, as one alternative to replace it. This would be another alternative: public investment turning around a fossil fuel economy into a clean energy economy. Like, that would be, you know, that this can shape, you know, what the United States and the world, because of the United States' influence on the world, looks like coming out of this crisis period.
And it really does feel like if you can pass a $6 trillion reconciliation bill, overseen by Bernie Sanders, you start to look at, like, you know, and I'm not diminishing the importance of voting rights, and the PRO Act, we should say, is embedded in this
right.
infrastructure bill. It's part of it.
Right.
If you can do that, it feels like the voting rights ends up sort of feeling like it's just like you're doing cleanup.
Right. Yeah. The cartoons are getting a little loud here. Virginia. Yeah. Turn it down. Yes, it does feel that way. It's it was hard to predict given Joe Biden's record. Like, yeah. I felt kind of weird using the phrase Biden agenda in the headline, because it's not his agenda.
No,
he is the president who happens to be in the White House while this turn is happening, while this crisis of capitalism is unfolding. And he seems to have bought into the idea that he doesn't have a whole lot of time left, and he wants to be fondly remembered for as a transformative president. I did not see that coming. But if you step back from personalities and take a more structural and kind of 30,000 foot view, then it makes a lot more sense.
Yep.
Bernie Sanders' success in 2016 and 2020 make more sense if you take a structural view. And then the fact that he lost, yet a lot of his ideas, and that he's overseeing this $6 trillion package, starts to make sense.
Ryan Grimm and the Grimm family, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ryan.
All right. See ya. We're going to take a quick break, folks. We'll be right back to wrap up the week. Well, we are, you know, we've been saying on this program that the second 200 days, or the second 100 days, is the new first 100 days. And
saying that?
Well, I didn't say it exactly that way, but we said a number of times that really that we're going to know in this second 100 days whether anything is going to happen. And it is all going to come to a head in July and possibly August. And it's starting to feel, you know, a little bit exciting. I don't want to get anybody's hopes up. It's going to be messy and dry, but a $6 trillion expenditure, really $7 trillion pumped into this country, is going to be, child tax credit to 25, the lowering of the Medicare eligibility age. This is going to be some good stuff. Knock on wood. But yes, we will have more to say about it when we come back Monday. Right, Emma, for our Peacock viewers?
Yes, we will.
All right. Well, then we will say goodbye to the Peacock folks. And hello to the non-Peacock folks. Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, I don't mean to neg you, as they say, but I know that your ego has gotten so big after this Crowder thing. I think I just got to criticize you on a regular basis just to take you down.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I can't even leave my house now. I mean, it is. I can't even walk around because of this whole Crowder thing. Yeah. Actually, to be honest with you, it is the funnest part was that my daughter was like, "Dad, you're all over TikTok." Well, speaking of Crowder, one of the things that we wanted to do today on the program, and do we have our guest? I guess we do. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to bring to the program a man named David Cross. David and I have known each other for close to 30 years now from our days in Boston. There he is. David, how are you? Say hello to Emma Vigeland is here with me.
Who?
Emma Vigeland.
Hi, Emma Vigeland.
Hi, David Cross.
David, this is something that most people don't know about you. You have been, I would say, modest a little bit about this. I think most people are probably familiar with your comedic work. Mm. But when I first met you in Boston, most of your day was filled by your day job, which was, I don't know what the technical term for it, but a body language.
Oh, you're talking about, yeah, body language purveyor of technical body language, an explainer, basically.
Yeah, and this is what your...
It wasn't my day job. It was my afternoon job because I had several, I had so many debts I had to pay. And my, that was my late afternoon job. It was, I made artisanal tartar sauce, which then I sold at Faneuil Hall, Quincy Market. And
I remember correctly, that did not do great.
I mean, that's relative. Great is relative. I made enough money to only lose a couple $100, which, that's a win in my book. My win book, was something that I was working on, and then collected all my wins in a book, sold those also at Quincy Market and then Faneuil Hall. So, body language, I don't want to say expert because, I don't want to step on anyone's toes, literally or figuratively. But I got very good at it. I was able to, tell you or tell whomever the psychological makeup of the person who was doing the body language, like what I'm doing right now.
Well, let me just add, I wasn't exactly explicit in wanting to sort of ask for these, for your expertise here when we spoke, and I probably should have been more so, but if you will indulge, I would like to sort of tap that expertise of yours. This week. I mean, if you don't mind.
What kind of time are we talking about?
It won't take long. 5, 10, 15 minutes tops.
Okay.
All right. Well, let me just ask you this one question. When you're doing this, what is that? What is that? Like what, like if I was doing that and you saw me doing that, what would you think?
I can only presume. It's also in the context. Right now, my tits are cold, so I'm warming my tits up, and that's what that is. A lot of people would think it's defiance or it's a defensive gesture, which it could be. I'm in a basement. It's particularly cold down here. Oh. So,
all right. I mean, if you want to,
I want to ask, like, can you read my posture here? What am I yeah. feeling? What's? I mean, I feel like it's kind of like when you ask a doctor to inspect you, and it's kind of, you know, maybe a little insulting. So I don't necessarily want to step on your craft here, but
okay. Well, it's interesting because your eyes opened up a bit when you said insulting, and you also did kind of a bit of an upspeak question. So when you do that, it means that says to me and others who have my particular skill, it's condescending. It's basic condescension to me. Well, now you're laughing, and now you're looking down while you're laughing. So this is all for.
Well, David, I mean, I hate to start off on such an acrimonious note with you, but
you're an interrupter, which tells me something. You don't let somebody complete their thought. And if I'm just going to posture, which was your initial question, I'd say laziness.
Wow. All right. Nailed it.
Well, yeah.
this is not, I want you to understand, these are not judgments. This is what you are putting out there to the world.
Right.
Okay. This is not a judgment.
All right. So you could do it. You're obviously not physically present with Emma. She's
on Zoom. This is a rude gesture. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're not physically present with Emma. You're looking at her on video. So
that's true. I'm looking at a two-dimensional.
Right. Well, so could you look at another two-dimensional thing? As you probably heard, I got into a sort of a debate, if you will, with Steven Crowder. And
I did not hear about that.
Oh, all right. Well, I got it.
I'm sorry. Who are you referring to?
Steven Crowder. So
I don't know who that is.
You've never heard of Steven Crowder?
I might have heard, and I'm not. Maybe if I see him, assuming it's him.
Can we put up the tape? Because let's start it. This guy.
I don't know. Okay. Kind of looks like a lot of guys, though. I mean, if I dyed my hair and had earphones and then jacked myself up and had my name in neon behind me, I'd kind of look similar. So.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Well, I would be curious if you could assess.
Oh, I can see it right down there. Ethan Klein debates Steven Crowder featuring Sam Cedar. Oh, yeah. So is this like a rap thing?
Well, no. What happened was Ethan Klein, who has a YouTube show.
I don't know him either.
Okay. He has a YouTube show that, you know, many, like millions of people watch. Steven Crowder has a YouTube show that millions of Cretans watch. And, they were ostensibly going to have a debate, but Ethan doesn't really debate. So he asked me to come in and be his surrogate debater. And if you could watch, because I'm curious of what's going on in Steven Crowder's mind during this, when this happens. Now, I should also tell you, I don't know if this makes it, he's wearing a holster. So I don't know if that,
it might inhibit his movement in terms of just, you know, you need to know all the facts, David, before analyzing this, right? His arm movement may be a bit restricted. Yes. I mean, as you can see, he's wearing
I can see that now. I thought that was part of a baby Bjorn, but I guess not. Okay. It's a holster and it's a holster for
a gun.
And why does he need to be ready to shoot?
In case Sam Cedar comes on the screen, maybe just to make sure the computer servers go dead. Yeah. Which he probably should have done. You know,
he actually explains in this video why he is wearing a holster.
So this isn't common for him. He doesn't always wear. He's not.
No,
like,
he does.
He does.
Yeah.
Yeah, but is he pro like right to carry, one of those guys?
Yes, he is. He will say later in the video that he is trying to normalize wearing a holster. And I think from your laughter, it probably is not quite normal yet. So
No, I mean, I live in New York, so we're not afraid of imaginary, like when he's a white guy. So who's he afraid is going to, he's going to have to defend himself with, especially in his studio, which I assume he has some control over.
Yeah. The weird part is he's surrounded by producers who are not wearing holsters, which is
maybe they're all trained in like Krav Maga or something like that.
It's possibly. So if we could play the video and you can maybe like, you know, just.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. So and tell you. OK.
Yeah. And tell us, you know, what you think he's thinking at any given time. And you can just say pause or whatever. However, I'm not sure how you would go about this, but you're the expert. So
yeah, I'll say pause. And
okay. Oh, geez. A lot of people watch him. You know him. Some of you like him. Some of you don't. Same can be said for me. Ethan Klein from.
What's that? Right.
So you can see his left hand is out. I'm assuming he's right hand dominant. And you can see he's tapping into his hand. I don't know. I can't see myself on the screen. I'm assuming you're. So he's doing this. Which is somebody who's clearly into both sides of S&M or BDSM. And that's what he's doing there. That's a self-soothing thing.
Yeah, the holster makes more sense now, right? That could be incorporated.
I think that's probably. I don't think anybody goes that far into their sadomasochism, or would be that open with it. But that's just a subtle, submission and domination.
It's like a thumb sucking, but for somebody who's soothed by being on both ends of an S&M situation.
Yeah, or a thumb sucking butt. Yeah. Okay. All right, go ahead.
Taking the time.
You're very welcome. And I just want to say, I know you called me. You said that I would be
the other guy, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's Ethan.
Yep. which is fine. And yeah, I think you're right, because I don't think I'm a very good debater. I think you know that.
So Ethan is distracted. Go back. Ethan was doing something.
Oh, okay.
Well, that man's definitely chewing on something. So, could be it. Now let's go back. What's happening? He's fiddling. He's coming up from fiddling with something. This guy. Wait. Or maybe not.
He's eating a pistachio, I think, or something. I think that's the thing that I.
Oh, he had his hand. Okay, looks like he was pushing an imaginary button. It was like an imaginary panic button, and a lot of people will do that, not being aware of it. But they're pushing. They want to get out of a situation. They want a trap door to open up. All right, keep going.
Too easy for you.
Oh, okay.
So I've prepared.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So Dan, what we were going to talk about is you know, the initial quote that happened. I think he's looking off there. The initial quote that kind of was turned into a little bit of a meme, which wasn't intentional.
Okay, and, he's just being standard conversational, slightly dismissive, nothing exciting or interesting. Really,
what about these breaths he's taking? Because, like, I think when he sees that that Ethan is looking off to the side, he thinks something's coming. And he can't seem to get through an entire sentence without taking a big, deep breath. Like he's trying to.
I don't see that. I do see preparation. I do see stealing oneself. But that could be for anything, really.
What do you see with his hands, though? He's clutching them quite tightly.
Again, that's part of stealing yourself, preparing yourself. But I don't see, it doesn't really seem necessarily too tight. Again, he's doing this fiddling. That's just self-soothing. That's that's just making himself comfortable in this situation. But he does, I don't know what this, the trapezoids, which he's clearly worked on quite a bit. Those are getting raised a little bit. So he's even though he's leaning in, he's still upright. And that's telling me he's preparing. Almost, this is called a mother bear syndrome. All right, keep going.
Sound.
And I disagree with that. I think people should think about it. I believe, and we talked about this through Playful Living, in an aggregation of medical authorities.
And he's looking straight on. This is good. There's nothing wrong or odd about this at all, Sam. So I'm not sure. scientific voices the whole is
to make an informed
and you're never really going to completely satisfy an explanation for why you're wearing a holster in your clubhouse or whatever it looks like, man cave type thing. It doesn't make sense. It's purely symbolic, but go ahead.
Formed and rational decision. So where do you think that I'm wrong on that?
Steven, do you know that the Spartans are... that they are like
practice nervous
man love with children. Gentleman.
Oh, geez. Okay, so this is what's going to happen. What did I tell you? He was going to do anything he could to avoid. Oh, there he is. Oh no, Sam Cedar. What a fucking nightmare.
Okay.
I had no idea this was going to happen.
Okay, stop for a second. By his body language, I can see that this is a nightmare for him. Almost one would say, would use expletives. Say, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I'd say for him, it's a, if this is okay, a fucking nightmare. And that speaks to latent homosexual ideation, but he seems very, to me, the body language is saying, this guy is saying, this is a nightmare situation. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, just,
what a fucking nightmare.
I don't want to, I have to say also his body language may be saying that, but he's also literally saying it.
I'm not listening. I'm looking at body language. I'm sorry. If you want that kind of thing, that's like twice as much money, Sam. If you want me to break down
just
body,
do
language
the body language.
And
the body language is more interesting.
Say.
We can hear the language part is actually just sort of like...
All right, well, then it's a freebie. I'll throw that in for free. Okay.
Oh, there he is. Oh, no, Sam Cedar. What a fucking nightmare.
Slams on the table. That's very petulant. That's what we call baby want to go poopy. That's when the baby, when it go like that. And he's listening to his body. You can see the sphincter tightens. There's fear. There's panic. And you can see this. He's putting on a brave face. He's definitely putting on a brave face. All right, keep going.
I had no idea this was going to happen. I thought Ethan was a stand-up guy. This is where we are. Yeah, I told Dave. Remember, I told you. I guarantee you, he's going to do it.
All right. Now there's looks like there's a little person in the room. I don't know who that is, but there's somebody who works with him, producer, somebody in that kind of capacity, who takes a seat. And what looks like it's supposed to be like an underground, cafe night bar type thing in a student film. I'm not sure what's going on, but he's sitting down. Let's take a look.
What do you think he can to avoid the debate?
Oh, I just think he believes that he should debate you.
No, he doesn't. He just takes advantage of women with, mental health issues.
Steven,
Ethan Klein doesn't stand up.
Okay, now we're not seeing the other gentleman. I assume that's intentional, so I can't really read his body language. You can hear that he's fearful. There's again, panic, scrambling. He's getting a little bit of cotton mouth or dry mouth, as we would say. And he's kind of filling in a lot of space because he doesn't know what to do. Okay, all right, keep going.
It's just hilarious. What's going on FM?
You would do anything to avoid talking to me. I think the point that you made
is
that it's
Joe Rogan.
Yeah, Joe Rogan
and Ben Shapiro
and Dave Rubin and Jordan Peterson and Noam Chomsky.
He's not on screen, so I can't really.
Oh, yeah. All right. I'm sorry. It was weird that he was hiding from the screen. And I think at one point, Ethan says, okay, there he is. We're back to.
But Steven. Ethan, look, hold on a second. Ethan, this is because initially I came on here to talk with Ethan.
Okay. He's casting a spell. Look. You can see he's casting a spell. When he does that, that's called the Odin, and he's trying to cast a spell. And he's trying to make everything go away. And it's, but he's not a dumb man. He knows that that's not going to work and spells don't really exist. So it's more of a projection of wishful thinking, go away, change into a bird and fly away. Okay, go ahead.
the same reason that I haven't ever had a conversation with Sam Cedars, the same reason that Joe Rogan, Sam Harris, Brett Weinstein, Dave Rubin, Ben Shapiro don't owe him anything. It's based on a lie, Ethan. Just
what's
like you
lie?
Claiming my Ethan.
What's the lie?
You claiming
Joe,
my
what's the
booker
lie,
reached
Steven?
Out to you, Ethan, when you okay, know that's
okay,
not
so,
true.
Stop for a second. So he keeps referring to Ethan, who's the original person he was supposed to debate, right?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So he keeps so he's clearly again, this is all part of the Odin complex, casting a spell, making it go away. He's not acknowledging purposefully. And I'm so sorry. What's the other guy's name?
Me?
Ethan.
Yeah.
Sam.
Oh, Sam. Oh. Sam. So he's clearly trying to make him go away, the presence go away. And it's also, you know, what we call the guy who's buying a cuckoo clock. He's buying time. It's a dumb way to refer to that because it's actually longer and it's more confusing. But that's called the guy who's buying a cuckoo clock, meaning the guy who's buying time. It should just be buying time. But go
technical
ahead.
Technical term, yeah.
I mean, we've known each other for.
There's
long.
No
What's
one
the
ducking
lie?
You,
Why
Sam.
Are you
I've
so
never
afraid.
Sam, yo,
listen,
Sam,
I
Sam,
think
Sam,
you're
Sam,
a
Sam.
Smart
I
guy.
I can call out Mike
I don't
Tyson.
Understand why
it doesn't mean that I'm ducking.
You are so worried about this.
Why do you
I
feel that? Why
don't.
Do you feel that anyone, Sam? Why do you feel that anyone owes you airtime when you have the 40th of the audience?
Yeah, and you know, wishing he was older. This is a thing people do when they wish they were a little older. And sometimes you wish you were older because it would give you experience and the faculties to deal with the situation. So it's you'll see kids doing this a lot. You'll see like 6, 7, 8 year olds doing this a lot, you know, on the playground. And it makes them, because they're trying to feel older. Huh. And he's just trying to be
That's
like
also,
a wise
I have to admit that, like, I remember when I was like 18 or 19 and I'm trying to get into a bar, I would go up to the bouncer and just be like, sure. Oh, could I come in here?
Yeah, yeah. Whether you have a beard or not, or just
right. Is there a chance I could come in here?
And it works. It works.
A lot, of times it would work.
Yeah,
a lot of times
almost,
it would work.
I'd say almost 100% of the time. Somewhere between 20 and 100% of the time it would work. And they go, you'd say, yeah, I'm here to see the, I'm here to see the dead Kennedys. And they'd be like, you know, do you have ID? And then you'd be doing this. And they go, do you have ID?
I must have you're left good. It. And, I probably said like, oh, I must have left it in my study. At home, with my
in your laboratory,
my laboratory. I'm a doctor, I would say, or something like that. In fact, sure. That's also when you go for kids. You mentioned 6 and 7 year olds. When I was too short to go on the bumper cars, that was also another technique. You'd go up and like, here's my ticket, and they would go, you seem to be a couple inches short of the line, but. You carry yourself well, and I will get in. That was one of the techniques. So.
Oh, interesting. Interestingly enough, that's how Too Short used to get into everything that he needed to get into. He'd say, here's my ticket. And then the guy would say, did the drummer get wicked? Okay, let's...
You've been doing
I
the
don't
show
think anybody
for 10
owes
times
me airtime. I think that okay. Ethan Wait, is that, just giving no, it to me. Okay. I didn't
right.
ask him for it.
And
right. so,
no, you've been begging
the real
for it for a long time. Everyone
Steven,
bigger than yourself.
So
he found
you about
can't build an audience.
With
and so what
why
happens is he uploads
so
15 times more,
do you think
has less than a 50th
says,
of the audience.
Well, that's why he wants to debate you, is so he can build his
audience. Sam, come on.
Your audience cares that I only have 1 million subscribers and you have what? 6 or 7 million subscribers.
Let me answer. Can I answer your question? Can I answer your question? Can I answer your question?
Sure.
You want me to answer your question? My audience would
okay,
say
that's
Sam
classic.
Who?
That is a classic thing that a lot of people do. I'm not, this is no judgment on him, but they'll do the classic. They know they're so close to having a point. They're just not quite there yet. And so they jump in and they do the, can I answer your question? But they'll repeat it 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 times while the person is saying, sure, yes. Go ahead, giving them the space to answer the question. They'll keep repeating it. Can I ask you a question? Yes, I've already said, can I ask you a question? And what they're doing is, again, that's the guy going in to purchase a grandfather clock, buying time while they try to formulate the thing that's going to give them another few seconds to buy some more time, because they're clearly backpedaling. So let's go back to the thing.
You're buying a grandfather cuckoo clock.
Yeah.
A million right. subscribers, and you have what, I'm sorry, 6 or 7 million subscribers?
So grandfather clocks, it's like, a square is a square, a rectangle is a rectangle, but a rectangle is always a square, but a square is not always a rectangle. So a grandfather clock is always a grandfather clock, and a cuckoo clock is always a cuckoo clock, but a cuckoo clock is always a grandfather clock. It is.
Can I answer your question? Sure. You want me to answer your question? My audience would say Sam who? Just like Joe Rogan's audience and Ben.
Okay, well that's an anti-Asian. Okay, that's anti-Asian. I don't appreciate that. I don't like listening to that. And I think it's a low blow and beneath anybody. I don't know this guy. Seems beneath him and beneath this YouTube, whatever we're doing. I don't know what this is, Sam. I know I'm in my office, but
right.
You know, you and I are old friends. A lot of time we'll have drinks or we'll text on the phone, but we don't do this. This is not how we communicate. But I don't want to get dragged into this kind of
Give me just 2 more minutes because I'm curious as to this next part. Is that okay?
Now they all know who you are because you had to shoehorn yourself into another college show.
Every day that you do that,
Let me clarify, Sam.
Again, he's casting spells. He's trying. This is a combination of pretend handball. It's called lazy man's handball and casting spells. And it's a combination of the two. Where you go like this and you're moving things around and you're trying to, it's like you're playing handball, but from a seated position in a way where the ball is always going to come back to you. It's a little masturbatorial. And then he's also casting spells, wishing you away. Go away. Go away. And I'm one more time with your name.
Sam.
Sam. Go away, Sam. Be gone. Be gone with you. Handball, handball, handball.
I get the projection of a spell go away. What would lazy handball do for you? I'm not sure I follow.
It keeps you active in your mind, and it allows you to to think as you're going. Like, yeah, I'm fit. I get some exercise. I don't just sit around the house. I play handball.
It's a game, right? So it's maybe reverting to some sort of childlike, frame of mind.
I mean, that's the first game kids play is handball. You play freeze tag, you play duck, duck, goose, and you play competitive handball. Okay, go ahead.
Changed my mind. Everyone knows on the show, right? Yes. We've had
how
professors
did you know
on the-
I ended my show early last week?
Okay, this is when he's doing this. When he goes back like this. That is, that's a very kind of a narcissistic thing. I want you to look at, it's about grooming. He's imagined he's had a full day spa treatment. He's had his hands and fingertips in the things. He's gotten them, a little buff and some, things that you put on, that the daintier of us will put on our fingernails. And he's just showing you, and it's a
French tips.
Say what?
French tips.
Sure. And he's just keeps showing them to you. It's a dominant. It's a way to make you feel, beneath him.
Like less fantastic in a way. Like you feel
less glitzy.
Less glitzy. Less fantastic. Less glitzy. He's saying like you're basic. You're basic.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm more fancy.
He's showing you.
I'm fabulous. Yeah. I'm fabulous.
It's not just visual. It's there's smell to it. There's what is the main ingredient in nail polish? It's that lacquer that very strong. It's a very strong smell.
Smell my fingers. Smell my fingers.
Yep. Take a whiff. Take a whiff.
Okay.
Because you're an idiot, and half of your staff doesn't like you.
Because I'm a diehard fan.
Yes, it's because he's a diehard fan.
If you're a diehard fan,
but I just met you.
Why not?
Congratulations, Sam Cedar's fan.
Steven has a conversation.
This is all confusing. Now here's this gentleman again. I don't know why. That's the same thing with the hands, but he's doing it at mid chest range, which is also waving his his funk at you, getting his funk on you. You know, you're one of mine. Get here. You know, it's very ape-like. It's primal. It's primitive. You know, and I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to be honest with me because I don't have time to go through all this.
Okay.
I'm watching all the actions, linear, putting it all together. Does he? Is this the big twist, the surprise? Does he eventually throw his poo at you? Is that where this goes?
No, he does not. There's okay. no, I mean, not.
Okay, I haven't. I mean, look, I haven't done this in quite a while. This was a long time ago, as you acknowledged back in Boston when we were.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so let me just. It's been a while since I've done this.
Let's just do another, minute, if you will indulge us.
Yeah, and right now, I'm trying to talk with you. You're interrupting, Sam.
You bombarded the show.
Okay, you bombarded my show under a false pretense. You claim that ever, just like you claim that I ducked a debate with you under a false pretense. Have I ever?
That is what the Politicon people told me.
Oh, is that what they told you? Well, so you're just lazy with your research?
Okay, well, that's interesting. That's interesting. So that's called the Mini Pearl, and I don't know how many of your audience will know this. Mini Pearl was a very iconic Grand Ole Opry figure, a figure from the Grand Ole Opry Mini, and she was on Hee Haw, which is a show that was syndicated that, I mean, again, your younger viewers won't know about Hee Haw. Unfortunately, I grew up in the South. That was one of the very few things that we had for entertainment. Minnie Pearl was a big, she was this kind of, you know, white segregationist kind of, you know, affected character. And and part of her shtick was she'd have price tags still hanging from her hat. And she'd be, you know, the kind of school mom, the Southern woman, older, a very older matriarchal, you know, that kind of white, dowdy, but feminine yet masculine at the same time archetype. So what he's doing is the Mini Pearl.
But why would a guy whose nickname in high school was Tubes from Canada, why would he be doing... why would he be portraying a Southern segregationist white woman?
But this isn't conscious, Sam. He's not doing this consciously. These are all things that your personality comes at. You can't hold your personality back, whether it's ape-like, whether it's a pathetic wizard, whether it's an old racist, segregationist, Southern Baptist school marm. These are things that are part of us that come out through our gesticulations and things and body language and things that we do that we're not even aware that we're doing. So
all right. So let's, I think we can end it here because it feels like we've got a full on assessment of Steven Crowder. He is like an ape-like, but also like a Southern segregationist Bell who wishes he had wizardry that he does not possess. Is that
Your words, not mine.
Well, how would you characterize it?
I would say he's hard on the outside, soft on the inside.
Okay.
That's nice.
Yeah. All right.
Now, I assume you don't need that skill set of mine anymore. But now I have a question for you, Sam, because I'm not as well versed as your. I've never watched the show. I've been on it numerous times, so I never watched it. I'm not. I know you from. I've always enjoyed having discussions with you. Sometimes I disagree with you, sometimes, you know, vehemently so, and we always have good discussions. That one time we were playing the Who's Hitler game, you know, mm-hmm. There was a big issue with that. Right.
Secret Hitler, yeah.
What was it? Secret Hitler.
Secret Hitler, yeah.
And would you... debate that guy? I can't remember his name. Would you debate him?
Steven Crowder.
Yes. Would you, Sam, debate Steven Crowder?
Sure.
I want you to say right here, right now, in front of everybody, don't be scared. Would you debate him?
Yes.
Yeah. I want you to think about this. Okay.
All right.
Is this something you would do?
Yes.
You would debate Steven Crowlin. You would debate him.
He was supposedly a comedian. I think he said, he was very upset that I was not a stand-up comedian.
That you weren't?
Yeah.
I think he said that you were upset that you weren't a stand-up guy. That's what he meant.
Ethan. No, he said that to Ethan. Later in the thing, he bemoaned the fact that he couldn't find any stand-up of me online. And I said, well, that's because I'm not a stand-up.
Right.
And he was...
He was upset?
Well, then he felt validated in a weird way that that his search...
How would that validate his...
because that's why he couldn't find any stand-up of me online was of course, because I was not a stand-up. And so,
well, that's an interesting thing, and maybe something your viewers could use as a way if they're feeling down, if they're feeling, their self-esteem is low and they want to validate themselves, just apply the word stand-up comedian to whoever, and then go and try to find footage of that person, Julian Castro or, whoever it may be. Charlie Morton, the pitcher for the Braves. So just somebody, whoever, and say they're a stand-up and then try to find footage of them doing stand-up. And then when you don't find any, go, look what I did.
Exactly. Right. You don't even need to do it with just stand-up. It's like, I'm going to see... If David Cross, I want footage of David Cross driving a Formula 500 car.
Well, that exists. So not a good example, but
or trick snowboarding.
And that also exists. So again,
working.
Oh, we get the idea.
Right.
We get the idea.
Yes. But yes, the bottom line is yes, I would debate Steven Crowder. That was the whole.
Hey, all right. Enough. Why don't you get in touch with him? And say, hey, let's have a debate, Steven Crowder. And guess what? His volume, his level of volume can be greater than yours if he wants. How about that?
He can pack some heat. I would be okay with that.
Yeah. Okay. What are you afraid of?
Me?
What are you afraid of?
That's my point. That's why I went on.
Well, then debate him. What are you bringing me into it? This is on you, Sam. You go debate him. Call him up and debate him. Don't be scared. Is that for me? Are you trying to get me?
He's casting you away.
Okay.
Cast a spell. Oh. David. That's the whole point. I was trying to debate him, but, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming on and, taking the skill out of the club. I hope it was fun for you to do this after so many years.
I was a little rusty at first. I'll be honest. I had to shake the rust off, but yeah, it is fun. Once you get into it and you can arbitrarily assign things to random gesticulations and blinks and things like that, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I think you did quite well at it. So yeah. I appreciate
6 years with the CIA.
What's that?
6 years with the CIA.
Oh. That's pretty good. I didn't know, but I guess I wouldn't, right? Yeah. That's the whole point.
Are you allowed to reveal that now, David?
That I spent 6 years with the Culinary Institute of America? Sure. I don't think they don't have a problem with that.
Now I understand why your Putinesco was so perfect.
Light on the salt.
David Cross, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. All right. Well, there you go, folks. Yeah. I mean, David Cross, a lot of people did not know he had that skill. And now they do. All right. Let's, we're doing a freebie Friday, folks.
I need to take my break.
All right. I'll read some IMs. How's
all
that?
All right. Thank you.
Majority Report wardrobe coordinator. I heard a conservative talking point from reporter John Roberts in the Washington Examiner that Democrats had used the filibuster over 300 times in 2020. Can you debunk this? I'm assuming it's something like you can still symbolically filibuster judicial nominees and then it gets overruled. I mean, can I debunk it? I don't know. I can't debunk that they didn't use it 500 times either. It's absurd. It's absurd. What? I honestly, I don't know what that means. They stopped 300 pieces of legislation. There is no filibuster for judicial appointees anymore. Prada Comunista. Remember how after the Civil War, Confederate traitors were executed? Not. Adult film actors, Sam Seder. Shout out to the AM Quickie for observing 30 seconds of absolute silence for Steven Crowder's reputation today. David, you should disable Twitch chat until they prove themselves capable of not being homophobic and speculating about people's sexualities. That shit sucks. Same goes for all of you regarding Crowder. Embarrassing. Look, you know, I will just tell you that my experience in the aughts was that some of the most homophobic people turned out, particularly Republican lawmakers, turned out to be gay. And there was a process of self-hate that they had because of the context in which they lived, or maybe, you know, maybe it was family, or maybe it was, you know, they're living in a very conservative era for that matter. And their self-hate got turned outwards. That's the only thing I can respond to in terms of, like, you know, without knowing the specifics of what you're talking about. And that it's a real dynamic. Animal Psyche. Sam will almost assuredly be wearing a tank top. Philly is my spiritual animal. Hello, Samantha. Can I get a shofar for my new job? This show, especially Michael, have influenced my ideology to the point where I'm proudly accepting a role with Philly DA Larry Krasner. Thank you for the inspiration. I look forward to calling you updates. Oh, my God. That is super exciting. Oh, bear with me. This is interesting. Mitt Romney, maybe. Joking on the square is what I think Al Franken used to call it, where you're telling the truth by telling a joke. And here is Mitt Romney on NBC News after the celebration, I guess it was, or is this before or after the big announcement that they had come to a negotiated settlement with.
And we should say that this is because, like, he makes this comment in context of Sinema has some sort of issue with her leg. So she's wearing one of those. What do you call it? I mean, it's like a crutch, where knee crutch, you kneel on it and you walk with it. Anyway.
Try to cut out the peg leg.
It's amazing what it's amazing what she'll do to get the cameras to follow her, right?
I'm the opposite. I think you're confusing me with Joe.
So,
pretty passive aggressive Mitt Romney there a little bit.
A little passive aggressive Mitt Romney, and also a little, you know, I mean,
I appreciated
she takes a
it.
Shot at Manchin. And, you know, look, this is all just joking around, but clearly this is a joke that other people make around the Senate, how much Joe Manchin likes to be in the center of things. And, of course, it is the case. Yes, probably of all of them, frankly. And just a little insight in there.
Well, I mean, Sinema likes the camera on her, too, but for different reasons. Joe, in terms of, I would say, the negotiating, he wants to be at the center of things. And she just wants to, you know, be on camera for wearing a fun top or being a renegade, but not necessarily the one who's front and center in terms of, I guess, maybe I'm making a distinction without difference, honestly, because she was a part of the leading this bipartisan talk or whatever the case may be.
Yep. Meanwhile, the other big story in the right wing world is that the Joint Chief of Staff, Mark Milley, said something that was, I don't know, I thought it was pretty, I don't know, it was pretty banal, really, in many respects, right? I mean,
he went up against Matt Gaetz, who was trying to characterize things, and he did it in a pretty aggressive way.
Yeah, I mean, he just basically said that we should be reading, we should be reading critique as well. And here's Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson's got to. This is an opportunity for Tucker to address his white nationalist following.
Milley got the job because he is obsequious. He knows who to suck up to, and he's more than happy to do it. Feed him a script, and he will read it. Here's Milley yesterday, the man in charge of this nation's weapons, explaining that he's working to understand a concept called white rage.
I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university. And it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white, and I want to understand it. So what is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? What caused that? I want to find that out. I want to maintain an open mind here, and I do want to analyze it. It's important that we understand that, because our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Guardians, they come from the American people. So it is important that the leaders, now and in the future, do understand it.
Pause it for one second. How is this, like, what he's saying there? This is what's sort of fascinating to me about this. What he's saying there just sounds like almost like every New York Times article we read for 3 years, which was like, you know, why are Trump voters so mad? What he's saying there is just like, we should be aware of what drives these different phenomena. This is the most sort of like banal and lacking judgment statement one could imagine. But here's Tucker. This is an opportunity for him, so he must strike.
Hard to believe that man wears a uniform. He's that unimpressive. Notice he never defined white rage, and we should know what it is. What is white rage? Well, like drapetomania, it's one of those diseases that only affect people with certain melanin levels. It's a race-specific illness. That's what Mark Milley has learned from reading about it. That's why he's making his soldiers read about it, too. They need to know. Watch.
I've read Mao Zedong. I've read Karl Marx. I've read Lenin. That doesn't make me a communist. So what is wrong with understanding, having some situational understanding about the country for which we are here to defend? And I personally find it offensive that we are accusing the United States military, our general officers, our commissioned, non-commissioned officers of being, quote, woke.
He's not just a pig. He's stupid. So Mark Milley reads Mao to understand Maoism. He reads communist to understand communism. But it's interesting that he doesn't read white supremacists to understand white supremacy.
He didn't necessarily say that. I think he was targeting his audience because it was Matt Gaetz who initially asked the question. I think a lot of people would say that they read Mein Kampf to understand Nazism. It's just a straw man he's knocking down. But he called him a pig. This is going to get zero coverage. Imagine if anybody on a liberal network did that about someone in uniform. Imagine if Ilhan Omar said something like that. There would be multiple attempts on her life or death threats at the very least, or Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden or Nancy Pelosi. I mean, any Democrat, honestly, but of course, the progressives and people of color, too. So but he's just going to get away with it. If and Laura Ingraham goes on TV and she talks about how she wants to defund the military, which, by the way, deal. Awesome. I mean, if the roles were reversed, we would never hear the end of it. I mean, we didn't hear the end of defund the police from their end. But they get away with murder because, you know what, they can make some aesthetic argument about wokeness in the military. Yes, you're right, guys. The military, the CIA, the FBI, they're way too woke, and we probably should dismantle and reevaluate the funding of those institutions. Let's go.
I am definitely in favor of defunding all of those institutions. I am also in favor of them reading different types of work. Now, what's
in the meantime,
let's go back to this drapetomania, he said, because I think in the end, what Tucker is really complaining about is that there was an opportunity to promote his book when he was calling on the general for suggesting that maybe what you should be doing if you want to learn about white supremacists is to read a book by a white supremacist. That was obviously a subtle plug for his own recently released book. But go back to where he says drapetomania. Do you have that, Brandon?
He's that unimpressive. Notice he never defined white rage, and we should know what it is. What is white rage? Well, like drapetomania, it's one of those diseases that only affect people with certain melanin levels. It's a race-specific illness.
Pause it. And so drapetomania was a, back in 1851, the American physician Samuel Cartwright suggested that the cause of enslaved Africans fleeing captivity was supposedly a mental disease. That's why they fled captivity. And it's interesting to me that he's so steeped in such stuff. It's not a common thing.
Well, I mean, is it him or is it another one of his white supremacist writers caught on a white supremacist forum who just drops that into the... I mean, of course, we know Tucker has sympathies for that, but it's incredibly specific, as you say. So might just be another one of his writers being a bit more covert about their online activity.
And to be clear, you know, the idea of rage, it is... obviously, there can be all sorts of different rage, but the point of this, you know, so-called white rage is racial resentment by white people. I mean, that's just the bottom line, right? Like, it's coined, I think, I don't know if it's coined necessarily by Carol Anderson. We've had her on this program a couple of times for a number of books. But what it is... It is specifically she's referring to that every time we have had in this country any type of significant either material or symbolic advancement for Black people in this country, there has been a backlash by white people. Look at Reconstruction. We've gone through the massacres that took place there. And then the growth of the KKK by 1920, you had 6 million, 6% of the American population as card-carrying members of the KKK. You look at the blowback from the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and the Dixiecrats leaving the Democratic Party because of it. You look at the reaction to the idea that we have a Black president and what it did for, you know, increasing hate attacks and whatnot. I mean, this is, and then actually like a, you know, a new era of sort of Jim Crow voting laws being passed and being accepted by the Supreme Court. This is what we talk about when we refer to that concept of white rage. It doesn't mean that every white person has it. It is a, it's a measurable phenomena in our society.
Right. But just the phrasing of it triggers Tucker. So, you know,
he doesn't like it.
Well, he doesn't. Yeah. It's all about this multi-decade project of people like Tucker Carlson to play up white victimhood. And if they're perceived as being rageful, at least, you know, he makes it about the human being. I know you're chomping at the bit about this J.D. Vance thing.
Just let's put up this J.D. Vance tweet series. This is pretty funny. He is mad about the this is his first tweet. Is, I personally would like American generals to read less about white rage, whatever that is, and more about not losing wars.
Well, I mean, maybe he would know what that is if he read about it.
Maybe, but that would take a long time. Instead, he just replies to his own tweet by saying, what I find so enraging about the Joint Chiefs pandering on progressive wokeness, they know damn well the geography and politics of who dies in American wars. That's what he finds so enraging about somebody talking about essentially black rights, right? I mean, that's what that is. He finds it enraging that there is somebody in an institutional point of power in society even acknowledging the idea that black people may not be treated the same as white people in our society. That is enraging. And what is this white rage that's supposedly, I don't know what that is.
And specifically an institution that was a safe harbor for people like J.D. Vance, where they were protected and their feelings were not hurt and they were not triggered because it's authoritarian in nature. And there's strict rules about what cannot be said and what can be said. And there's a hierarchy that people can stick to. And, you know, we've been fetishizing this institution for so many years, and yet somebody who wears that uniform and is on that team is not abiding by our vision for society. So, I mean, incredible,
it's enraging.
Incredible lack enraging. Of self-awareness. And it's probably one of those things when you read a word and then accidentally say it a few times, but also just like indicative of his latent, you know, bigotry and rage.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. Let's check in on old Dick Morris, shall we? You remember this guy?
I remember old Dick.
Old Dick Morris, toe-sucking advisor to President Clinton back in the day.
Excommunicated and now needs to find his home on wherever this is.
Yeah, he's the latest sort of, Pat Caddell. He's basically falling in Pat Caddell's footsteps.
He's also kind of Dershowitz-y.
Yeah, he's got it all. And here he is, expert on critical race theories. Incidentally, we should say that it's being reported now that the Republican caucus in the House, they're going to run on this critical race theory. I want people to try and remember, like, 2 years ago, when Donald Trump was running on Colin Kaepernick, same stuff. Or when he was running on whatever black person du jour that he had found was offensive, same stuff. Here is Dick Morris.
What do you make? I mean, this is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff making a comment like this. What
incredible.
Do you make of that?
Incredible. This poison, critical race theory, this cancer, is affecting all of our institutions, the schools, the universities, the military, all over. And it's based on the fundamental proposition that all white people are racist, whether they are inherently that or not. Their background makes them racist.
Right.
Original sin, really.
Yeah.
And that all white people got where they got by exploiting blacks. I have a unique thought about that, though. What does this do to the children? What does this do to a kid? A quarter of all black marriages are intermarriages racially.
Wow.
So what does that do to a black boy?
A black and white kid?
Whose mother is a white and whose mother is black and his father is white.
Right.
What does he think? My father exploited my mother and that's how he got successful? And if the couple breaks up, do they have to choose one over the other? Does it reinforce the Oedipal notion all kids have, wanting to kill their father and marry their mother? what does this do to the children? And to have a fourth grader sitting in class who might be white, being told that everything his family has and everything he enjoys and has accomplished is because they exploited other people. What a vicious thing to teach.
Seems like a little bit more about you than anything.
First off, I will say that is an incredibly unique and very specific and narrow and also a make-believe thought that Dick Moore has had. It's all those things. Unique, rather implausible, and also a fundamental misunderstanding and misrepresentation of what critical race theory is, and also misrepresentation as to where it's taught. It's taught in law school, and fourth graders are not in law school. What he is concerned about is that there's like any type. This is just a game for this. This is Sharia law. This is, marriage equality. It is just, it's Colin Kaepernick. It's go on and on. It is just what they've decided to run on this time around.
Right. And also, you know, I love too when conservative, like white dudes largely, they just misappropriate Freud and they don't necessarily think that there's been any, you know, advances in psychology since then. Like they're still really steeped in the incredibly sexist teachings of Freud, and they just like they took a psych 101 class and they think they know everything, and then he mixes it into his misappropriation of critical race theory. But as you say, like it's a cancer, right? You know what is a cancer about it is literally the fact that Fox News created this controversy out of whole cloth, and now we're having representatives in the U.S. government asking government officials about it, where, you know, no one can define it, but everyone's upset about it now.
Yeah. And it's just going to get, we're going to hear about it a lot more, folks. We're going to hear about it a lot more. Which one of these? Let me do a couple IMs. Emma, you pick out which clip you want to do. Should we do that Portnoy one? I don't know. Oh, let's just play this Tim Pool thing.
Oh, okay.
I don't want to spend too much time on this because, you know, every moment that you're talking about Tim Pool, it's just an opportunity for the time space portal that send those guys from that different planet, world through. And then the Avengers have to show up and all that. You don't want to crack something like that open. But Tim Pool.
There he is. Looks a little different.
Apparently got very angry about the whole Crowder thing. And people remember this. Tim Pool was on Twitter publicly saying, like, we don't have any left wingers who are willing to debate me. And I wrote, I'll do it again, Tim. And he DM'd me. He's like, can you do it on the 13th or something like that? And I'm like, sure. And then it became clear that he wrote me like, well, my producer will be in touch with you to work out travel arrangements. And I was like, what? Travel arrangements? What do you mean? Like, I can't travel to like on a, whatever it was, a Wednesday or a Thursday. I got my kids.
It's also in the middle of COVID. Yeah.
And also, I'm not going to go into a studio with you with COVID. There's going to be. And then he said, you lucky you backed out, you disingenuous liar. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. So he got on.
And he had Ben Shapiro. He said he couldn't do it over virtually. And he had Ben Shapiro on the next
day.
Well,
to be
virtually.
Fair, I think he was on Ben Shapiro's show.
So
he didn't
sorry.
Have his own branding behind him or whatever it was. But be that as it may, he said he couldn't do Zoom in his studio. maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. I don't know. But then he saw the whole Crowder thing and he figured, I've got some money to make in this. And so he jumps in. That's what he does. And then this is all just a long introduction to my favorite meme that someone made. This was Merkida on Twitter at There's Brian, at There's Brian. And I think he made this, or she made this, or they made this. And this I really enjoyed.
Utilitarianism is typically the villain in most movies.
I don't care.
Yeah, so for instance, like Thanos.
Thanos.
The part where Thanos is so great. God, I love that.
We gotta
play
now.
I know what that scene is because I, you know, Saul made me watch that because he's 8. So I watched it.
Can we play that song?
Oh yeah! Since we're on this, folks, go and watch this song on YouTube for when you record it for your new ringtone, because I want this guy to get the hits from it. But this is so fantastic.
Jonathan Mann. Yeah.
Sam Cedar, what a fucking... Oh, there he is. Oh, no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare. Oh, no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare. Oh, no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare. Oh, no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
I always respect people who enter into the arena. You do anything you can to avoid the debate. Come on, man. Idea that you were taking your show off early last time. I had no idea this was going to happen. Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare. 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 I always respect people who enter into the arena.
Seems that even Crowder had gotten some cold feet, so I don't think he's coming.
Why is that?
I would love to ask him myself. He's not even answering anymore.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare. 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 I had no idea this was going to happen. I thought Ethan was a stand-up guy.
That breath at the end too is so fantastic. Jonathan, man, I gotta say, like, I'm so excited. I hope that like outlives me on the internet for years and years and years. I am so excited about the existence of that. I just honestly, that was just
immortalized.
It was just fantastic. It's a great tune. It's a really great tune. And
Song of the Summer. Yeah.
I hope it becomes like covered by a lot of bands coming out for the first time after COVID. People doing live shows. What a great live show cover.
Well, if we ever do that live podcast, we can, you know, have somebody do a rendition.
Oh, that's a good idea, Emma. And I'm not going to tease it, but it's been in the works for a while. We've been waiting. We were supposed to do that show in November, celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the show. And then, of course, COVID happened. So, Mine Pillow Guy. Sam, when are you going to finally do what you've been teasing for years now in primary Chuck Schumer? You can do it for one reason and one reason only. So we get to hear Steven Crowder say, what the hell is a senator? Senator Sam Cedar is irrelevant to my audience. Salinas Lefty. Looks like Nina's special election is on November 2nd. Oh, the primary is on August 3rd. Okay. And Empa Bauner. Sam, quick question. Would you consider yourself a Sock Dem? Because you seem to love Sock Dem nuts. Miguelito. Emma having trouble finding a book. Might I suggest the public library?
I'm not having trouble finding a book. I'm having trouble getting into the book that I hear is so good that I'm reading right now.
Oh, I see.
But I'll have a ton of time on the train tonight. I love my stepmom. I'm just like, I want to relax, and I just got to take a long train. So I'm being
train is a great way to relax. I love taking the train.
I'd rather just be in my bed, but yeah.
Train is fantastic.
It's train boy. Time to IM in.
Fierce Deity, 73. The election in August is the Democratic primary. Obviously, it's a heavily D district, but the winner, hopefully Nita, won't be elected until November. Oh, okay. Is there any chance that the parliamentarian tries to kill the PRO Act in reconciliation, or does it have explicit budget implications? I got to think. They have been talking to the parliamentarian for over like 5-6 weeks now. I got to think that they have a sense of this. We would start to hear stuff. But maybe. Redbird Menace, hello from Iowa. I've been doing some research about the early mid-20th century progressivism in Iowa, and we are currently in the grips of the Kim Reaper and Alec drones in our legislature. But Iowa once had a history of progressive politics and folks like Henry Wallace. What do you attribute the diminishing of progressivism in rural places, and is there a way to revive it? I mean, I feel like this is like, you know, something we should refer to an expert about. And I imagine there are some books about this, but my guess off the top of my head would be that you have, we have less of an agrarian society. Much of that energy has moved to the city, and that we don't have as many small farmers anymore. And it's mostly, you know, much more larger agribusiness. And so that populist fervor against banks are not sort of, it's not as a significant feature of rural areas. That would be my guess. But yes, and young people move out of state. What do we got here? This is not good. Let's play this. I mean, look, just because Laura Ingraham says cut the military does not mean this is a bad idea. In fact, despite the fact that Laura Ingraham is calling for it, it is a very good idea. Maybe she's not wants to cut it for the same reasons. Who cares?
She doesn't even want to cut it, though. I mean, she's saying that now. But it's a good opportunity to seize on it and say, look, you know, we can bipartisanship. It's possible, or whatever the case may be.
Exactly. And look, I understand the impetus to use the military as a leverage, you know, within the context of our politics, because it's so sort of loaded. And, you know, back when we were doing AM talk radio, the Majority Report, you know, we had a Fighting Dems segment where we would promote vets returning from Iraq, running, who are against the war, running for office. And it was, you know, it was a powerful sort of like political feature. I had Jim Webb on. That didn't work out so well. There was a couple others who were a little bit better. But play this thing from Joy Reid. This is just wrong. Like, it's just the wrong attitude. Good. Conservatives target the U.S. military over race studies.
Awesome.
Let's. This is a twofer, folks. Yeah. You can say that, yes, of course, the military should be studying questions of race and all sorts of questions at their universities. You can say that, and you could say, and let's cut their budget. Play this.
Representative Houlihan, I guess that I'll throw it to you. Are Democrats prepared to go out there and explain to voters that it's Republicans who now want to defund the military? They tried to use defund the police, which is, by the way, DOA as a thing, right? It look at New York City, where they just elected the most pro-cop person to be mayor, or at least they're close to it. That's not a thing. Defund the military is a thing. They're saying it on Fox.
Yeah, and
pause
I want to back all
pause
the way
it
up.
For 1 second. Defund the police is a thing.
Yeah.
We have seen budget cuts to police around the country. I think, what is it in, is it in New York? What city is it? New York? Has it gotten rid of the police?
Rochester. And in Austin, they've done similar projects.
Yeah, I mean, that's absurd.
It's actually way more of a thing than defunding the military. I mean, that's a very narrow view of politics. If just because someone on cable news says it, then that's what makes it a thing.
And there's a lot of reporting to suggest that many people did not know Eric Adams' position on policing, A, and B, that it was a function of the fact he was the only person who was a politician and had an existing infrastructure. Not to mention the win of a, you know, someone who's a police reformer up in Buffalo, but also a police reformer as the DA in New York. But continue. So, and look, we should hope that defund the military is a thing on Fox, but of course it's not. But continue with this.
Right. It look at New York City, where they just elected the most pro-cop person to be mayor, or at least they're close to it. That's not a thing. Defund the military is a thing. They're saying it on Fox.
Yeah. And I want to back all the way up because I hadn't seen those tweets that you referred to about the Viet Cong. And I'm literally nauseous. My father fought in Vietnam, my grandfather in Korea. You know, the idea that we can be trolling and not understanding the consequences of this. One of the things that struck me about General Milley's testimony yesterday was a continued reminder that from him that not just the people in that room are listening to the things that we're saying, and not just the people who are watching Fox News or this show are listening. When we're talking about defunding the military, the very thing that allows us to be the people we are, say the things that we're saying, and to be the nation that we are, the democracy that we are, other people are listening. Our enemies are listening. And I think what's remarkable about the Democratic Party right now is that we get it certainly much more than the Republican Party does right now.
Yeah.
And it's an important differentiation and distinction that we need to be making.
This is grotesque.
Yeah.
This is grotesque. I mean, it's grotesque. The idea, like, our enemies are listening. And if we were to in any way cut the military budget, it's conceivable that we wouldn't have double the amount of the entire world's expenditure on the military. I mean, give me a break. This is horrible. This is like very, very bad rhetoric to have out there. Far more dangerous than anything that they're talking about. In fact, we should encourage the conservatives to cut the military. And like Emma said, just say like this is an opportunity for bipartisanship. You know, and now,
well, they love it in every other instance. They're so excited about it. On cable news and. In terms of the Democratic parties and that representative there, I'm sure, you know, bipartisanship is a part of her rhetoric. What's the name? What's her name?
Chrissy Mahal. I don't know.
But here's an actual opportunity for it, which fits into progressive ideology. But,
the
you know,
idea to make the Democrats the party of the military. Give me a break. How about both parties become the parties of cutting the military?
It's so reactionary. It's just, it's, you know, there's it. Go on.
It's nuts. Melancholy. It's all coming to a head in August, just in time for Trump to reclaim his throne, right? Interesting.
Yeah, true.
Real ace attorney, Pro Football Talk and Chris Sims, I'm buttoned off, are on the air for 6 weeks. We're off the air for 6 weeks. I'm relying on you guys to get all my football info for a while.
I'm really sad that the show's on hiatus for a little while. I listen to it as I eat my breakfast. So,
Hunchback of the Gowanus Canal, one word, sambushed. Champagne Communista, Emma did a fantastic job on TYT last night. Absolutely killed it.
Thank you.
Also, Sam, congrats on the Cavs. Thank you. Samicky, fight like hell. Like and subscribe. In a socialist group chat, I read this exact quote. Unrelated, Steven Crowder got ambushed the other day into debating a dude I've never heard of until yesterday, Sam Cedar. If I remember correctly, it's goddamn hilarious. You think a dude is walking around with two pistols would be ready for anything. Appears not. You reached a bunch of new people for sure. Oh, this thing. as sort of like juvenile and stupid as the whole thing is, it actually, like, I think, it's going to have like a,
you've destroyed his credibility.
I think that it probably shook at least some of his audience. I don't see how it couldn't, frankly. I mean, even just, I just don't see how it couldn't. Peach Keen, very unprofessional. Corner Mr. Cross on your show in order to save a buck on hiring a body language expert. Dutch boy, Sam, you need to go on more shows like Ethan's and similar big ones. I've seen the huge increase in your subs since then. Cold tits. Ooh, sorry. I would love to be living in a universe where I don't know right-wing pundits' names or even popular YouTubers, just a head full of body language wisdom. Orion, I just want to say thank you to the crew. I've been listening since 2014 and a member since 2016. I was on furlough due to the pandemic and canceled my membership. You gave me access, which I greatly appreciate. I signed back up for a paid membership the other day. As I'm back to work, thanks for getting me through the past year plus. Left is best. I can't tell you how happy I am about all of that. Thank you for that note. Abe, Dave is my favorite. Is he going to make a movie where he murders a room full of people like Bob? Your left testicle. Having David Cross on made my day. It's easy to forget not everybody in Sam's age group is as conservative as he is. Redacted from Portland. I love that you're back in the studio now because I can hear Matt's laugh from the background, giving me real Michael vibes. Angel, how do you play Secret Hitler? It's actually a great game. It was...
I've played it. It's just a little weird to be just like, you're Hitler. I don't know. Maybe I'm a snowflake, but I like the concept of the game. I just don't really...
I played with Cross and Nathan Fielder and Benjamin and a couple others, and I won. Nathan was a little mad.
Oh, yeah?
He was showing everybody how to play. He was a little mad. Because I don't spare anybody. I don't spare anybody in that. He got a little mad because he was the one who was. J3000, any Demon Slayer fans within the MR crew or nah? Matt? No?
Matt says no.
I don't know what that is.
Have your dream mail model. This Steve guy seems very aggressive. What's his deal? I really hope he stays away from college students and isn't trying to change the kids' minds or something, because that would be bad. JJ Cool. Hey, Sam, I appreciate that you allowed comedy on your show today. I did have trouble following along with the difference between a grandfather and a cuckoo clock. Could you clear that up for me? Quintel Pro. Sam, that was some masterful clout stomping of Steven Crowder. Robocat. Yesterday was my birthday, and as I've done in the past, I am asking for folks, if they can, to donate to Adrian Shelley Foundation, a nonprofit organization that promotes and provides grant scholarships to women filmmakers. I would also appreciate retweets of my pinned tweet at Robot Monkey Cat, which has related links. Left is best, poggers. I used to know, I auditioned for Adrian a while back. I mean, back when she was alive, and knew her husband back in the day too. Such a sad situation with that. But yes, Robot Monkey Cat at Robot Monkey Cat on Twitter. All right, five more of these and then we're out of here. Trench Warfare, you say that you'd be okay with Crowder packing heat in a debate with you, but would you be okay with him casting spells at you during the debate? That would be wrong. Michael from Bavaria, did you see that libertarian Yaron Brook wants to debate Sam? I did not, but let's do it. I don't know how to get in touch with him. You can tell him he can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com, or you can just tell him, I guess, to email us, or we can Google him. You can have him on this show. That'd be like a fun. That would be very fun. Do that during the fun half. There we go. I've never heard of him, but as long as he's a libertarian, I think that could be fun. Cower with Crowder. Tucky, who never served a day in his life, has stayed in his castle saying he's unimpressed by Jeremy Millie is hilarious, if it wasn't so sad. so sick of the Lovejoy defense. Kids are a lot smarter than the average Republican hog thinks they are. Jay Tingle, our military allows us to say the things we're saying. Does she realize what she's saying? Yes, I don't think so. Mailman Paul, critical race theory is the new Sharia law. Correct. Train boy, what type of train are you taking, Emma?
The regular train, yeah, out of New York. I won't say where I'm going, but
are you leaving a Penn Station or are you leaving
Grand Central? I got to transfer twice, and then after that, I got to take an hour and a half car ride. So like, it's not, whoa, you know, it's not. But I'm being a baby about it. I understand that. I'm being a baby about it. All right.
I love riding Amtrak.
I do. Amtrak's different. You got the snack bar. You can have a glass of wine. Although I think I'm going to bring some White Claws for my sister and myself. Jesus. So
there used to be a bar car on Metro North too.
Oh, really?
Yep. That's what my grandfather told me.
I train boy, you know the story. I took a train from Oakland to Boston one time. That was quite a ride.
Train boy, I really want to ride the Sunset Limited at some point. So if you got any advice on that.
I had a friend that... I had a friend coming back from Boston who didn't have any money coming from Boston to New York, and he just went on the Amtrak and, you know, changed from bathroom to bathroom for the whatever four hours that it was on. Anyway.
Judy Rugliani, David Cross is the GOAT, and the final I am of the week. Here we go. Jordan Boggs, Father Sam, I emailed about a class action lawsuit regarding misclassification, but I'm sure it got buried in your hate mails from the Crowder fans. Also, I hope the MR crew enjoys the weekend. Longtime fan. Jordan, send another email. Bump it to the top. Folks, Matt, Brendan, Emma, great job this week. See you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there.